Hello, this is Kevin Doherty, your host for Just Thinking. This podcast is presented by MarketScale. Today, I have a really special guest. This is an individual that I've met through a group called the Human Intelligence Movement, and we'll probably talk some more about that. And if you want to learn more, just listen to the last podcast that featured Dr. Michelle Ament. So, and she shared a lot of wonderful things about the Human Intelligence Movement. But before I go too much further, I want to give Michael an opportunity to introduce himself to you. So, Michael, tell us about yourself.
Yes, Atamarie from Aotearoa, New Zealand. I'm Dr. Michael Harvey, Director of E-Learning at Marlborough Boys College here in sunny Blenheim.
When do you have time to sleep, Michael? Because what time is it in New Zealand right now?
It's 7 a.m., but I was actually up for a HI meeting at 4 a.m. this morning as well. So, yeah. I do sleep, but not for long.
So, Michael, as we talk about HI within the framework of artificial intelligence, so we talk some about the differences between the two, and then how the two can work together symbiotically, if you will. So, what are your thoughts about the importance of human connection in this AI era?
Yeah, I think it's important that our education system now looks at nurturing the human intelligence. What that human intelligence actually is something we're working on in our research committee here in the Human Intelligence Movement, whether it can be quantified, and also the human attributes. I think the importance of the relationships is basically the idea of diverse thought, and the power of diverse thinking and different experiences which humans can bring to the table. Because artificial intelligence does not actually exist in the physical world, whereas humans do. And because of those different experiences, they bring different approaches and different outlooks to problems.
And one of the things that frames our knowledge and information is our point of view, our unique point of view, our unique perspective, and our unique experiential background. And that every individual brings a different set of those pieces to every situation.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, the fact is that I'm from Aotearoa, New Zealand, so we have a very big underpinning with Indigenous knowledge systems due to Te Tiiti. So that's kind of what I bring to the human intelligence movement, different kind of Indigenous perspectives of knowledge creation and actually how to teach or how to even create an education system based on Indigenous values. And I think those particular values are what we need right now. The idea of building connection, the idea of respecting each other, the idea of we're all learners and that kind of mindset.
You know, as you're sharing that, Michael, I'm reminded of some work I did in the state of Hawaii. And in Hawaii, when we were looking at the data disaggregated by student ethnic groups, at the time that I was there doing the work, the group that was scoring the lowest was the Native Hawaiian student population. And I was sharing this with a gentleman who was a Native Hawaiian. And he just, you know, snapped back at me. And he said, "Who's determining the level of intelligence? And what is it based on?" He said, "Our children are incredibly intelligent." And I thought, absolutely. But he brought a different frame and a different perspective to this whole idea of student achievement, student performance. And he asked the right question: based on what? You know, what are they determining some of the things that we know as Indigenous people of this land about the sea life, about the environment, about, you know, dealing with the various climate changes and so forth? There's so many things that we know and that we share from generation to generation. Are these things that are being assessed? And I thought, wow. He just schooled me right there standing on the beach while my son was getting a surfing lesson. So I just thought, wow, this is it. We need to be in situations like that that open up our eyes and our minds to looking at things from different perspectives. So I want you to speak a little bit more to this, because I think this is an incredibly important topic when you talk about the use of Indigenous voice as we we grapple with this balance between HI and AI.
Yeah, I mean, I used to teach overseas, and one of the curriculums that I taught was International Baccalaureate. And one of the parts of International Baccalaureate is the theory of knowledge, which I really enjoyed. And it breaks down the epistemology of different knowledge systems. And so, for example, Indigenous knowledge, at least in our New Zealand context, is very collectivist. So when I compare that, say, to the US model, which is very much the individual student succeeds, whereas in New Zealand, we take a more holistic approach, the idea of when the collective achieves, then we're all achieving together as a collective. So that kind of different framing of education, that we're actually all a community of learners learning together, and that can incorporate the teacher and also the student. So we're both learning from each other. So I think of my experience in a couple of hours in front of my junior science class. So they will be learning some things around distillation from me, but I'll be learning skills like patience from them. So we're always learning together. Yeah.
Well, so on that topic, this whole idea of a need to transform education systems with AI as a catalyst, what does that look like to you?
Well, I guess from the way I'm looking at it from an indigenous framework would be a more human-centric one. So basically, AI is being used to kind of augment the building of the relationships. So the fact we're having this conversation now using technology and using artificial intelligence is an example of artificial intelligence augmenting human connection. So we call that whakawhanaunatanga. So it's the idea of, it's the verb to build whānau or family. So technology, AI can facilitate that through technology. Another thing is the concepts of manaakitanga, so the idea of respecting individual learners' prior knowledge and utilizing that prior knowledge to drive engagement. And things like wananga and ako. So ako, which I've just mentioned previously, is the idea of the tuakanatena model. So there's lots of Māori words floating about now, but it's the idea that the student and the teacher are interchangeable. So you can have a younger person teaching an older person, a teacher teaching a student, but also a student teaching a teacher. And it's basically creates a web of community and knowledge. And I think one thing lacking is conversations, for example, with stakeholders. So here in Marlborough, we've had a conversation with our local tribes, what they want to see as success for their students. And it's the same thing with a conversation with their parents or parents of our students, what they see as success. And we'll develop something called a graduate learning profile. So that's not necessarily academic. In fact, the parents didn't have academics as the top priority. It was about the idea of cultivating human attributes. So the idea of leadership, the idea of being a lifelong learner, the idea of being problem solvers, and the idea of being able to navigate through life, which is actually building up what it means actually to be human in this world.
Well, I so love that. And I know there are districts throughout the states that have been shifting to more of a holistic approach to assessing the effectiveness of a school or a district rather than relying strictly on test scores as the only determining factor of, is the school doing a successful job of preparing students for career, life, whatever path they choose to follow. So I love that. Hey, I did want to say too, when you said Marlborough, I was born in Marlborough, Massachusetts, in Marlborough Hospital. So we have a little bit of a connection there because I forgot that you're at Marlborough. So I love that. And also, I'm just thinking about this whole idea of the flipping and flopping of the teacher and the student, you know, kind of shifting roles. And thinking back to when I was first teaching, I studied multicultural education at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And as part of that experience, we were to go to another country to do our student teaching. So I went to the UK and worked in a primary school there in the British system to do my practice teaching. And so I obviously it had influence on me when I came back to the States and became a teacher. But it was very clear to me from the start, and I taught third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, a little bit of sixth, but, you know, young kids between 8 and 12 years old. But I always felt as if, in so many instances, they had as much or more to teach me than I had to teach them. And I have a lesson that I learned from a student who was an 8-year-old girl in my class that really schooled me in front of all of my students about a given topic that I have never forgotten to this day. I'm 63 years old. I was probably 25 at the time. But so many lessons that I learned along the way. I think it is important for the educators, though, to have the mindset to be open to this dynamic that you describe of kind of this role of teaching shifting from student to teacher and back and forth. So would you speak a little bit more about that? Because I know that's not traditionally something that we see a lot of happening, at least here in schools in the States.
Yeah, it's actually kind of, I think the reason why New Zealand has got to this position of relational learning is because of the large indigenous population. And it'll have something called reflective practice. So basically, I'm constantly reflecting through student voice about how my teaching is going and whether it's actually working or not, and adjusting it in real time. And I think that flexibility is something that humans can do. And it's also about respecting the students for who they are, rather than just seeing them as a test number. I teach boys primarily because it's a boys' school, kind of archaic in the US system, but we still hold on to the British things of those kind of gender-based schools. And especially with boys, it's very relational because I've also taught girls, and this is obviously stereotyping, broad brushes, but boys tend to have to develop a relationship with the teacher before they can start learning, which I guess is something that AI still cannot do. So I won't be replaced at least for the next 5 years. Because without that relationship, they kind of do that, just shut down. So you do have to nurture that relationship before learning can happen. And I think that's an important aspect of being a teacher in New Zealand, and it does kind of drive our education system. And I think it's a particular strength, the relational teaching aspect of our curriculum and our education system.
You know, Michael, it seems critical to address teaching from a relational standpoint, in part because of the way the human brain was designed to attend to that which is emotional and or meaningful. Pretty much everything else the brain dismisses. So with AI, what are some ways in which using AI to augment what's happening, you know, from an HI standpoint, to ensure that we're addressing the emotional and the meaningful side of the learning?
Yeah, I guess the advantage of artificial intelligence for me is it allows students to access quick feedback on their learning, which then I can see in the background and I can go and support that individual student through developing those relationships. It frees up time to do that, gets rid of that kind of paperwork. I guess also the other advantage of artificial intelligence is around the social emotional learning aspect. So the particular large LMS I use, basically the students submit a little monster emoji after every assignment, every lesson. And so I can actually aggregate that data through artificial intelligence to see different trends in the classroom. So you can see actually if the class is happy or not as a whole. And also I can break down and see individual students, because with the emoji, they also have a word that they can type or a sentence they can type with it. So in one particular case of a student last term, he was giving angry emojis and certain key terms that were not positive. So I could then intervene with that student, recommend them to the school counselor, and then we could put interventions in place. So that was one of the powers of artificial intelligence to allow me to do that.
So, Michael, as we move forward, and you mentioned the fact that the education system is going to need to transform, what are some things we can be doing, should be doing, to ensure that that transformation does, in fact, take place?
Well, I think one of the realities of an education system is that assessment is a driver. So I think we need to be changing our assessments. Primarily, I get a lot of feedback from teachers around students cheating with AI, and I think we need to reframe that. So rather than obsessing on catching students cheating, we need to be obsessing about catching students learning. That's one of my mantras. Because the Turnitins of this world, it's about 53% accuracy. It really hits English second language and neurodiverse kids. So it's not effective. But in saying that, if we're just asking our students to regurgitate knowledge, then obviously AI is going to smash that. That's just bread and butter. So we do need to change our assessment models in order to highlight human skills like metacognition, which are domain specific or Yeah. So one argument could be, okay, here's an assessment. Here is an AI-generated response. Can you critique this response? How can you improve on it? What are the errors? What are potential ways you can develop and enhance on this as an example of an assessment? So kind of that way, it's moving now more into assessing those human capabilities that we need rather than just assessing recall, which AI can do very, very well.
So what I'm hearing you say is that the incorporation of AI in a very purposeful, intentional way in which you just outlined it could help make the shift to more of an asset-based mindset and approach when we're looking at our learners, as opposed to a deficit-based approach. Do you see AI helping to facilitate more of an asset-based approach to teaching?
Not AI in particular. I would say a transition in an educational framework would do that. But I think AI can assist in nurturing those higher skills. So again, an example could be, okay, so the artificial intelligence here is, again, three responses that the AI has created. Now let's work together collectively as a group. So again, that's that group and that conversation, that dialogue, which is actually at the heart of learning. I think Socrates was correct with that, about which approach is best to go forward with, or what would you change in three responses, or which one is the best response? Because it's actually through the dialogue and the discussion that actual learning actually happens.
So in terms of how your classrooms are structured, do you have to structure your classrooms physically different from how you might have done traditionally to facilitate more of this approach to learning that you just described?
My controversial education system I'm designing from the ground up now. Well, for example, year levels would not exist because you wouldn't be making the assumption that students are at the same kind of cognitive level due to just an age. So you could have 5-year-olds teaching 12-year-olds, or you could have 16-year-olds nurturing or developing 8-year-olds, all within the same class framework. It's radical. I know that'll blow a lot of people's minds, but that's because again, it's a community of learners. You'd even bring in like people from outside school to be teaching certain things. And like, for example, a business might have a problem in the community. They come to the school. We brainstorm it as a school or as a class, and we try and find solutions for that particular problem. So yeah, PBL is also a very important aspect of my vision for education.
Well, I love it. And Michael, I mentioned that I did my student teaching in London, and not every teacher did what my cooperating teacher did, but we had multi-age classroom. It was primary school, Singlegate Primary in the borough of Merton in London. And we had 6-year-olds to 9-year-olds roughly in the classroom. There was no grade. There was not a first grader, second grader, third grader. They were all at varied levels. And we were all very much a community of learners. So you didn't know. Sometimes the 9-year-olds worked with six worked with everything you just described. I didn't realize it, but I was being exposed to that at that time. And what my cooperating teacher, Jenny, would do is she would determine when a student was ready to go to the middle level school. So that might be at a younger age or an older. It just depended on the readiness of that particular student, not some arbitrary age or, you know, a specific curriculum. And so when she determined that those skills were present for that student to move on, then they were matriculated on to the next level of schooling. And it was a fascinating environment, so much so that I later got to work in multi-age environments. And what I loved about that was so often seeing the students take on the teacher role with fellow students and so forth and build more of that sense of community that you were talking about. Well, how do you feel things are progressing in your own situation with regards to achieving this ideal educational situation? Or on a scale of 0 to 10, are you a 5? Are you a 7? Where would you be, Michael?
Well, I guess in the New Zealand context, because we have tomorrow schools, every school is basically independent. So the Board of Trustees basically defines how the school will drive. To be honest, the mainstream education system, there are some innovative schools that are kind of moving forward with this, but it's not the majority. But and in the Maori non-mainstream, kura kaupapa, they're seeing massive achievement improvements using obviously kaupapa Maori teaching techniques. But it's interesting. The government is saying, well, you should be doing what we're doing. We come to us rather than coming to the kura kaupapa and saying, well, whoa, what are you doing? That's so amazing. What should be changing in mainstream education? So it's a bit back to front. I still have hope. And that's the thing. I mean, AI has basically rocked the boat in terms of, well, even Web 3.0. I mean, even before COVID changed, well, it was going to change education. We seem to have got the idea of we're going to go back to normal. But I think we are witnessing with very high truancy rates. I don't know if it's the same in the States, but at least in New Zealand and Australia, that students are voting with their feet, saying, well, this education system is not fit for purpose, so I'm not going to turn up. And I guess the government at the moment in my country, because we've had a change of government, basically putting out the stick rather than seeing it as an opportunity to make some change. But there are small little areas in New Zealand, like kura kaupapa, that are making those changes. And they didn't even make a change. They've just been doing what they've been doing for the last 500 years. So slow steps.
Well, and how are you broadcasting the message of the success in your situation that maybe might get greater attention than it's getting currently? Like you said, the government's saying, hey, you got to do it our way. But we're having such great success over here. At what point will they have to pay attention? What in what ways can the message get out there, be broadcast to where it cannot be ignored?
Yeah, well, I've just joined a working group for the AI Forum here in New Zealand. So I've now joined. So we're looking to make those changes. We've got some change makers, and it's about spreading the word, and that's what we're trying to do in New Zealand at a grassroots level. At this particular moment, through artificial intelligence as the kind of Trojan horse, but it's building bigger transformation rather than just focusing on the artificial intelligence.
I love it. AI as the Trojan horse. That's awesome. It's a great image. So, Michael, I know we need to kind of come to close for this particular episode, and we are going to continue the conversation. We're both part of the human intelligence movement. We'll be seeing each other and talking more, and we'll have other episodes to just hear more about the progress that you're making in New Zealand. But Michael, is there anything else about what you're just thinking that I did not give you the opportunity to address during this particular episode?
Yeah, well, I guess I had a very interesting conversation about 2 days ago on another AI online forum. And there was a bit of conversation around, well, why do we still have humans? Or what would make the advantage of a teacher being human over being just a artificial intelligence? And the argument was in 10 years' time, yeah, it won't make a difference. But I would still argue artificial intelligence still doesn't have three human-centric things. It doesn't have motivation. You have to tell the AI what to do. It doesn't have an intent. So, yeah, the AI doesn't have an intent in mind, whereas a human has a goal in mind when it's doing something, and it's what motivates it to learn, or it, the human, to learn. And you can't trust artificial intelligence, even though you might think you can. You definitely don't trust the AI. Whereas with humans, by developing that trust, you're building that relationship that, again, creates the dialogue, creates the learning. So I don't think we're going to be replaced quite yet.
Well, that's a good word for all the teachers and educators out there. So you heard it right here now from Michael Harvey. Michael, thanks so much for spending some time with me on Just Thinking today. And I look forward to future conversations with you.